This is Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Friday, March 12, 2021. Producing from his home studio in the foothills of Connecticut is Taylor Schwenk. I'm Buster Olney, working from my home studio in New York. And Taylor, just as we're getting ready to close out the day in terms of the taping here on Friday, we get word that one of the great pros, Nick Markakis, hanging him up, 15 years in the big leagues, 2,388 hits, 189 homers, 3 gold gloves, 1,046 RBI, an all-star appearance, and an incredibly respected teammate.
Oh my gosh, this is a big day. Nick Markakis, my favorite non-Cal Ripken Oriole. Love the guy. He played on so many. Yeah. It goes Cal, Nick Markakis, Brady Anderson, Adam Jones. That's my top four right there. Just a tremendous career. I was absolutely gutted in 2012 when he broke his hand. I think it was CC Sabathia hit him with a pitch and he couldn't participate in that postseason. And he was able to win a division, win an AL East, and got to play in a postseason, which was really nice. So incredible career. Sad to see him go. Hopefully we'll be still seeing him around the game. I don't know if he has an interest. He's kind of a quiet guy. I can't see him getting to broadcasting, but maybe coaching.
And being a dad, you know, being a dad for him is absolutely huge. And I would agree with you, quiet guy, but boy, you talk about respected among teammates that he had. So great career. Golf clap, definitely, for Nick Markakis with that, for the time he spent in the major leagues. We're going to be talking with Carl Ravage today about that memo that Major League Baseball put out yesterday about the experimental rules coming to minor league baseball this year. That's always a precursor for rules that are implemented at the major league level down the stretch. Sexual assault allegations are clouding Yasiel Puig's future in Major League Baseball. John Barr of ESPN is reporting that Major League Baseball investigators have interviewed a woman who said free agent outfielder Yasiel Puig sexually assaulted her in a Staples Center bathroom, but have not taken further steps due to her desire to remain anonymous and are awaiting further evidence to emerge from the lawsuit. This a source told John Barr. Some teams renewed the contracts of onside players yesterday. Among the eight that happened with, Shane Bieber, the Cleveland Indians, who of course won the American League Cy Young Award last year, and the Mets, Pete Alonso. Let's get to the good stuff. Mike Trout, first home run of spring training yesterday.
Here's the next pitch on Trout, and he lifts one high into left field. Going back on that one is rough, and it's Trout of here. He hit it out. A home run for Mike Trout. We mentioned he had been kind of quiet so far this spring. He was very loud with that swing.
Terry Smith with that call. Ronald Acuna Jr. also went deep.
Need some more at-bats to get some timing down. Swing and a drive. There's some timing. Let's put a timer on that. How long is that going to stay in the air before it hits the berm? Home run. Ronald Acuna is first of the spring. 1-0 Atlanta.
And this was good news. I got to text my friend Matt Viscursion, who, of course, is part of the Sunday Night Broadcast Group. Fox Sports West announced yesterday that Matt Viscursion will be the Angels' new play-by-play announcer for Angels Telecast. Very cool. You know, Matt is absolutely a fantastic announcer. So excited that he gets to have that opportunity in his home state. Two other things I want to mention before we talk to Carl Ravage, before we talk to Kylie McDaniel about the draft and Jenny Kavnar about the Rockies as we continue our preview in the National League West. First, check out Stephen A's World, streaming weekdays on ESPN Plus. You can also find the best interviews from Stephen A's World available as a podcast every Wednesday. Listen wherever you get your podcasts and watch Stephen A's World on ESPN Plus and listen to ESPN's newest podcast, First Take, Her Take. This week, Charlie, Kimberly, and Shanae are talking to Good Morning America's Robin Roberts. Roberts talks to the gang about advice for her younger self, climbing the ladder in a male-dominated industry, her royal wedding story, and so much more. Follow First Take, Her Take, and listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match. With Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of the show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Buster. Just go to Indeed.com/Buster right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/Buster. Terms and conditions apply.
For the ones who get it done, Grainger offers high-quality supplies and solutions for every industry, as well as access to product specialists who have the knowledge and experience to answer your toughest questions. Plus, their commitment to being your safety partner can help you keep your facilities safe and your people safer. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by.
All aboard. It's the Rabbit Train with Carl Ravitch.
Carl Ravitch, host of Baseball Tonight. Of course, you see him doing play-by-play on baseball games for ESPN. And, Rabby, when I saw the memo come out from Major League Baseball yesterday about these experimental rules being tried out in the minor leagues, got to tell you, I was pretty fired up because I knew what you and I'd be talking about.
Everything short of seven innings. And I had a really good explanation yesterday as to why, you know, something like that didn't come up and other things that, you know, that are maybe in the pipeline that weren't mentioned, but again, all with the idea of creating more interest in a game that's seeing its interest level, you know, wane.
That's interesting. So you kind of buried the lead there. So, I remember writing an article 8 or 9 years ago in which I quoted a major league executive suggesting, you know what, you want to shorten the games, make it seven innings. And I got to say, in the last 2 or 3 years, I've heard more and more sentiment about that at the team level, where they're like, if you really want to shorten the games, that's what we're going to have to do. So tell me what you've learned about that concept.
Well, I think if you just take the concept, I mean, the idea of seven innings means you're taking two innings away. And on its surface, that means you are acknowledging, well, we'd rather see this shorter. We want, it's in a sense going to a movie and saying, wow, I wanted to stay for 2 hours. Please cut off the last hour when it may be the most important part of the movie. In this case, the goal, you know, of the people making the decisions shouldn't be how do we cut innings off. It's more how do we make those two innings more watchable, make them something that the consumer wants to have as opposed to cutting it off. So that part of it, if you just, again, you take it, because I've been a seven-inning guy, and it's, you know, rooted in urgency, et cetera, they're like, well, if we cut two innings off, we're cutting off some seats from the bus when we're trying to get as many people on the bus as possible. So that's down the road if in fact, these other things don't work and, you know, try to move baseball in a direction the NFL is and the NBA is and come up with appeals. In a sense, it's acknowledging the folks that take their phones out and use them and have shorter attention spans as opposed to discounting them and then trying to figure out what it is about that particular group and the things that appeal to them. How do we get that into our game without cutting the game off, without shortening the game artificially by moving from 9 innings to 7 innings?
You know, it's interesting, Carl. You started that by talking about, you know, that's like going to a movie, you know, that's 2 hours and that being reduced. When you and I were kids, a 2-hour movie may have been a little bit on the shorter side. You know, the long ones were when they were 3 hours. Now, most movies are like 90 minutes.
Exactly. Yeah. And they made the move. And so did the music industry. I mean, you think about it. You don't hear Stairway to Heaven songs being made very often anymore. There's a reason that the music industry decided that we need to have songs, you know, that last between 60 seconds and 2 minutes. And that's really it. That's what works. And yes, I agree with you. When we were growing up, you know, a 2-hour movie was, you know, right kind of in the middle. We'd see longer ones, and then The Godfather's the aberration. But you're right. Most of these, and that's why I'm not necessarily in agreement that seven innings isn't the way to go. I've been, you know, as you know, a cheerleader for that concept. And it's not that I don't want to see innings 8 and 9. It's I want to see those seven innings pack as much action and urgency as you can into it and allow a starting pitcher who, when we were kids, would give you 8 innings. Now it's go out there, throw as hard as you can for as long as you can. And don't worry, we have 7 lifelines in the bullpen that we're going to use. And those are parts of things that need to be addressed.
And oh, by the way, most of those guys coming out of the bullpen, when they come in, they're not throwing 95 down the middle. They're throwing breaking ball after breaking ball after breaking ball. Deeper counts, you know, essentially trying to trick the hitter out of the strike zone. So it'll be interesting to see where we go forward 7, 8, 9 years from now. But for now, the experimental rules are talking about, you know, we heard this phrase, remember, 2-3 years ago, spikes in the dirt. With the positioning of infielders, part of the experimental rules is going to require the infielders to have spikes in the dirt. What do you think?
Yeah, again, and I think a lot of these things are rooted in strategy. Spikes in the dirt are one where you are dictating where the defensive player needs to play, you know, stepping off the mound, limited times to throw over. I've tried to shy away from affecting the way a manager manages his own team, and internally I'm able to draw a line between how many pitchers can be used, because that is a strategy thing, with things like you have to have your defensive infielders all on the dirt. For me, there are parts of me that understand it, and then there's still a side of me that if a guy is a dead pull hitter and my goal is to get him out, well, then I need to load up the left side or the infield or the right side of the infield. And it's a difficult one. But as I was told yesterday by somebody who's involved with these things, A, anytime you are trying to make dramatic change, there are going to be difficult conversations. People are going to be pissed off. They don't want to hear it. They are going to ask you, what are you doing? Why are we doing it? That's all part of the process. And if they believe and their research shows that by having spikes on the dirt and none on the outfield grass, and that's going to increase the amount of action we see, so be it. I was told, Buster, you think about football, you get a snap every, what, 30 seconds? Sometimes if the offense is in a hurry up, you get it every 10 seconds. In baseball, you don't have action. Assuming a ball in play is action for every 4 minutes. That's an interminable amount. When you're starting to talk about Generation Z, 4 minutes, they've done 17 things in 4 minutes. We're trying to ask them to sit patiently and wait for something every 4 minutes. It won't work. So if this is going to increase action, you know, I'm all for it.
Yeah, I've told you, my son Jake is a perfect focus group for Major League Baseball. He's 16 years old. He is absolutely sports crazy, talks about it all day, loves watching the Titans, love watching, you know, the first quarter of the Hornets game with me, won't watch the last three quarters because that's too much of a time investment. And when I ask him about the idea of sitting and watching his Atlanta Braves from beginning to end, no chance. And he says flat out, it's too slow. So you understand, you know, what's behind all this. Depending on the preliminary results of the experimental rule change, Major League Baseball may require 2 infielders to be positioned entirely on each side of second base in the second half of the Double-A season. And Carl, I can remember when Rob Manfred took over as commissioner and you asked him about, you know, would there be some sort of a rules regarding positioning? And me and the baseball, you know, folks in the baseball world went crazy. And now I feel like it's inevitable. What'd you learn about that one?
Yeah, I think it is. I remember that question. I remember him kind of, you know, looking at me like, we're not outlawing anything like that. I don't see us ever outlawing that. And again, you know, I just want to go back to what you just talked about with your son who's 16, and a Major League Baseball is attempting to take, and I think what we hear a lot is when we were growing up, So that means you're going back into the 1980s and 1990s, and things, forget baseball, but everything was different in 1980 and 1990. So to go back to something that worked then, I'm not sure that that assumes it's going to work in 2021, meaning there are so many other choices for your son and people of his generation, that just because you do that and you create more interest, is that going to be enough in a very crowded social world? I don't know that, so I'm not sure the premise is accurate, and I think that's why I fall back on, you really got to, I think you need dramatic changes, you know. And it was brought up to me yesterday, whether it's having two infielders on each side of second base, that's a tweak. That's not changing the way that the game is observed, other than, you know, when David Ortiz comes up, when he was playing and you had three guys on the right side of second, we won't see that anymore. That's just not a big deal. Will there be more hits? Absolutely. And subsequently, can you then take those hits and turn them into stolen bases, which was another thing we saw a lot of growing up? Maybe. Is that enough? Maybe. I don't personally think so. And as I said, I think if you were to, again, and now that we're on Mars, if you took somebody from Mars and brought them down to this Earth right now, and they had a curiosity, where would baseball fit on their curiosity meter relative to the plethora of other options they have to be curious of, only in the sports world? Forget baseball, just in the sports world, where would it fit? And is there a way that when they land on planet Earth with this sports curiosity, to make baseball one of the first things that they become curious about? And what would that look like? And I think you would need dramatic changes. And I do think shorter games with more urgency and intensity is the answer. So while yes, I can see how having two infielders on each side of the bag is going to open up holes, no doubt about it. There's going to be another adjustment, either by hitters, but the constant adjustment is what this vicious cycle that these folks that are trying to figure this out is all about. I had a guy yesterday say, here's a concept, and it will never happen, but what if we move the outfield fences back 100 feet? 100 feet. Nobody would be hitting home runs. They would then be forced to put the bat on the ball, and you'd have more action. It's not going to happen, but you need to remove the incentive in order to change behavior.
All right, we got about 2 minutes left. Let's go rapid fire on some of the other ones that they're talking about. I love this. Pitchers will be limited to a total of two step-offs or pick-offs per plate appearance. And, of course, what that means is they're potentially will encourage more base stealing and base runners being able to, you know, to be more aggressive. So, in other words, a guy's leading off first. The pitcher steps off once. He throws over to first base. And then the base runner knows at that point, you know what? He can't throw over here, and I can go. I think that's a great idea. What'd you think?
Yeah, I absolutely will encourage base stealing. It will also discourage the guys from throwing over there. If you do it twice, well, I'm going to take a 28-foot lead. You can't throw over. Like, I'm halfway to second base. You have to pitch the baseball. So there is a kind of a fine line there, and I assume you would likely never throw over. What's the point of throwing over? And again, that means more pitches more quickly. So yes, I can see where that would work. And anybody that throws or steps off twice would make zero sense, literally zero sense.
Exactly. Major League Baseball expand testing of the automated strike zone. Where do you think we are on that?
I like that a lot. And again, I think that if for no other reason, it speaks to a generation that is used to seeing things like automation, that is used to seeing things on a screen, that are used to seeing lights, that are used to seeing and hearing sounds. I think that we should have the automated strike zone on a scoreboard in center field, and every pitch, the consumer, that particular generation can look up, and they'll know that's in the box, that's a strike, that's on the box, that's a strike. Bring in lights, bring in sound. I'm good with all that, because that's who we are trying to appeal to. And I don't think it is at the at the level that you are offending somebody who loves baseball like you or me. I'm not turned off by that. I'm okay with it. I'm good.
Yeah, I remember writing about this about 5 years ago, the idea that, you know, a strike three call in an automated strike zone would set off like walk-off music for a Trevor Bauer or, so something like that. It would be cool. And so the home plate umpire would almost be irrelevant if you had the electronic strike zone. You know, we'll see where that goes. But Carl, I agree big picture with you. There's no question that they need to find a way to get more action. You can't have 4 minutes between bits of action. That is not going to work. All right, sir. Thanks for your help on this. Great to talk with you.
Be good, Buster. Take care, buddy.
You can now stream the most MLB games on DirecTV without a satellite dish.
Yes, the clutch hits, the strikeouts, grand salamis, web gems, with nothing on your roof. So whoever's up there, whether it's roofers, Santa, birds, old-timey chimney sweeps, moody teenagers, thrill-seeking raccoons, you name it, they won't find a satellite dish. But you will find your MLB games on DirecTV. That means DirecTV is your home for baseball this season. Root, 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 with nothing on your roof. Call 1-800-DIRECTV or visit DirecTV.com. Sign up today. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Dogs are an important part of our lives. That means protecting them from parasites. Ask your vet about NexGard Plus, a Foxaloner, Moxidectin, and Pyrantel chewable tablets. NexGard Plus Chews provides one-and-done monthly protection against fleas, ticks, heartworm disease, roundworms, and hookworms. Plus, they're delicious and easy to give. Use with caution in dogs with a history of seizures or neurological disorders. Dogs should be tested for existing heartworm infection prior to starting a preventive. Ask about NexGard Plus Chews.
Tyler McDaniel covers baseball for ESPN. He, of course, is a prospect expert. He's a draft expert. And Kylie, in just a second, I want to ask you about the jockeying that you see at the top of this year's draft board. It's been interesting to, you know, talk with various teams about some of the choices they're going to make, and I'm going to ask you about that. But before we get to that, I'm curious about your perspective on what ex-CEO Kevin Mather of the Mariners said earlier this spring about he basically acknowledged about the service time manipulation of the Mariners prospects. And since then, I've had so many conversations with executives around baseball about whether or not that might have an impact on how teams handle prospects this year. That with the current collective bargaining agreement set to expire at the end of this year, there is an expectation that that issue might be addressed in some form or fashion. From your eyes, from your perspective, how do you think that that might impact how teams promote some of their best young players? Do you think it's going to make any difference at all in 2021?
We've had times around with Ronald Acuña Jr. came up and Chris Bryant came up where this became more of a focus, where leading all through spring training, the beat reporters will be like, hey, he's going to come up, you know, 14 days into the season or whatever it worked out to be that year. And it ended up not really affecting much. I mean, we've seen Pete Alonso, Chris Paddock, Fernando Tatis Jr., where the team, or Jason Hayward, where the team just didn't pay attention to it and did what was right and called the player up when they were ready. And so that happens sometimes, and it's certain sorts of teams. I think you and I probably guess who they are ahead of time if you let us guess. And it becomes a focus, and I don't think the teams that were going to sort of screw around with that didn't screw around with it. Your question is a good one, where I wonder if the teams that are inclined to screw around with service time are now not going to do it, or they're going to wait 21 days to make it seem like they waited some arbitrary amount of time beyond the right at the cutoff, because it's become both with the CBA coming up, depending on what happens with Kelnick, there could be, you know, a lawsuit. Like, there's enough smoke going on where it was like a discussion before and nothing really changed. And now that it's become an even bigger issue, and like you said, I would imagine there will be some sort of fix for this, because I think everyone thought it was an issue that needed to be fixed in the past. And now it's even more front of mind, given what Mather said. I think his statements could be one of the sort of, you know, after the CBA gets signed, one of those like, oh, this changed because of what that guy said and the fact that it went on YouTube. Like, I think it might be a pretty wide ranging impact, more than people may think it will right now.
I agree with you, and I'm sure you have too, a lot of conversations in recent years with folks at the team level about possible solutions, of, you know, it's conversations with agents about that. And, you know, what I, the feedback I get all the time is that the rules need to be adjusted so that teams are incentivized to call up their best young prospects rather than incentivized to hold them back. You know, the Tampa Bay Rays, for example, have, and you can't argue with their strategy under the current rules, they've absolutely maxed out the development time for these, you know, great young prospects. It certainly worked for them on the field, but it hasn't been so great for some of the players. And I think that's where you got to, you know, try to find a middle ground. And the best ideas I've heard are essentially to start the service time clock from the day the player becomes a professional. And that way, you know, a team controls him for 8 years or 6 years or whatever the amount of time is. And so if the player is good and is good enough and one of the best 25 guys, the major league team is going to want to get that player to the big leagues to take advantage of that time. What's the best idea you've heard?
It's been a version of that. I think everyone's kicking around the same general area, which is, I think, doing an arbitrary cutoff of this is the year where everyone becomes a free agent. You have extreme edge cases like Wander Franco or Fernando Tatis Jr., where the guys are going to get there at 2021, hit free agency at 27, 28, maybe even 26. And then you have your guys like Whit Merrifield or your later round college guys that are drafted at 22 and get there at 25 and then would hit free agency at, you know, 33 or something like that. And so you can't treat everyone exactly the same. There needs to be, like you're saying, something sort of merit-based, whether it's how long you've been in pro ball. There's like different tracks that have been used for the Rule 5 draft where international signees get a little more time than college guys who get a little more time than high school guys. And that sort of like graduated sort of different tiers of how you treat players. But yeah, I mean, I think this is this, and I think to a lesser degree, some of the tanking stuff, the incentives are there for teams to be anti-competitive. And so they're going to continue doing that until the incentives aren't there. We should sort of thank our lucky stars that there are AJ Prellers who will just, you know, spend to their ceiling and trade all their prospects and call up Tatis on opening day. So there's at least an example. Like Dayton Moore seems like a guy who is like in the area where like he's not interested in taking advantage of these things, even though the incentives are there. Because I think they both see the advantage, and you saw it in Preller having a relationship with Tatis that led to this extension. There are like benefits you can't measure. And so the guys that are more into things that you can't measure will be more into doing these things fairly, but that's like five GMs at most right now. And so I think you need to, whether it's a lottery in the draft or trading of picks, like there's all kinds of things you can do to sort of pull these levers to make teams that are, you know, say where the Orioles were this offseason, to make them want to spend an extra $20 million. And if that is at the expense of the Dodgers spending $20 million, I don't think that's a bad thing. Like, I guess that would be technically like pointing at a salary cap, but if all the teams are forced to be a little more competitive and the very top spends 10% less, I don't think that's an awful thing for the sport.
Yeah. Peter Seidler, the Padres owner, obviously, you know, given the okay for a lot of those moves. Billy Beane has always been an anti-tanking guy. Yeah. Brian Cashman, the Yankees general manager, has been very open about that. And you're right. It is a small handful. I'm glad you pointed out Dayton Moore, who at the end of his baseball career, you know, at the end of his time as general manager of the Royals, will be able to go to sleep knowing that, you know what, I acted in good faith, and good for him in terms of dealing with his players. And the players recognize that too, by the way. All right, your number one prospect, Wander Franco of the Tampa Bay Rays. What do you see in him this spring, and what do you see with his timeline?
Well, he still hasn't played upper level minors. So if you, you know, if we want to get into the, are they manipulating his service time? Like, he hasn't even played in the upper minors, which is actually what's happened to Kelnick too. They both played in high A. So it is very easy to say they need to play a little bit more. We need to see them do what we think they're going to do in double A, maybe even triple A. Maybe that takes a month to actually have that question answered, or an extended spring training, you know, it's through to like April 1st or doing some minor league spring training. You'll probably know by then. So yeah, then the question is, if neither one of them, you know, we're talking about Franco here, will probably be up in the first month of the big league season. What if they're ready, you know, June 1st or so? With Tampa, they just have a lot of good players. They're like doing multiple platoons. They have a lot of depth, especially in the middle infield and especially at the upper levels. They have guys like Taylor Walls and Vidal Brujan that, for all we know, could be like a slightly better fit for a spot that comes open for 2 weeks. So I think what happens is somewhere around the All-Star break, there is some sort of slump, trade, release, guy gets hurt for a month or more, where a regular spot in the lineup opens up. And the best bet for the Rays, even as a non-40-man roster guy, is Wander. And so if that ends up being, you know, right field, center field, you know, a DH that plays a little bit, you know, third or whatever it is, I don't think it's going to be just Willy Adames gets hurt and comes up. I think that's a little too easy. He's probably their best option for any extended absence at any part of the lineup. So I would guess at some point by the middle of the summer, some spot opens up and he forces his way in. But he also just can have a minor injury or have a little trouble with off-speed stuff and like delay this whole thing by 2 more months. Because we're just assuming he's not going to hit a speed bump, which is like sort of the biggest part of this. And we're just sort of glossing over it.
Andrew Vaughn of the White Sox, a young player who's drawing a lot of attention this spring. I think the White Sox, you know, with Jerry Reinsdorf making it clear he's going all in trying to win. I think, you know, there's a good chance the White Sox are going to handle him aggressively. The question I had, and I asked the people in their organization, how comfortable are the White Sox promoting a young player into a role that'll include a lot of plate appearances at DH? And you know better than I do, a lot of teams don't like to do that with young players, but it seems like he's viewed as a different type of guy.
Yeah, he has been a, we'll say, professional hitter, for lack of a better term, since he was like 18 years old after his freshman year at Cal, where he put up, you know, Pac-12 breaking numbers. He went to Team USA and was really good. He also has only played in high A. So like, if you want to say he's not quite ready yet, we need to see a little bit more, I would be totally open to that. You could also see that his real competition there, if you say Eloy Jimenez is in left, and then Jose Abreu at first, would be like Zach Collins. So like, he's probably already better than Zach Collins, if I had to guess. So there's like a little, and then you have like Adam Engel and Adam Eaton and those guys floating around. It's like, yeah, he's probably, if you're just saying like as the DH, which guy do you want in that spot? I might need to see the full spring training, but you could argue that Vaughn is their best option. And they're obviously like a chips in the middle. Like they've been signing guys to extensions. They're spending all their money. They got veterans. Like this actually fits a scenario where you could see, you know, like a Pete Alonso, where you just have him up on opening day. We'll get this over with. And then the other issue, which had come up when Alonso came up, Vaughn will be 23 on opening day. If we're looking 6 years down the road and he's 29 or 30, like we're not positive this is going to be like $100 million Paul Goldschmidt type guy. Like that seventh year might not be that big of a deal for a not super athletic right-handed hitting first baseman. It often is not. And I think that may be the case with Alonso too, which actually he's beaten expectations, but this is another guy where when you're looking at, you know, Acuna or Fernando Tatis Jr., they're like, oh, these guys will be good until they're, you know, 35 or so. And they're up at 22. And with these right-handed hitting first basemen from college, it's like a little less of an issue where you have a little less of that worry that you're going to leave a bunch of money on the table. But also the White Sox don't seem worried about that right now. They seem to be worried about right now. So with him, I would guess, you know, maybe a month into the season, they'll figure out a way. It might not be opening day. Maybe he plays a little bit in Double A and then puts up huge numbers and then becomes that option pretty quickly.
All right, we got about 3 minutes left. Tell me about the 2021 draft and some of the decisions that are being formulated at the top in the top four or five spots.
So for right now, my best prospect is Jordan Lawler, high school shortstop out of Dallas. This is not a slam dunk. He has to go first, guy. If you put him in the top 100 right now, he'd be somewhere around the middle, which, you know, guys that went in the top five last year are there. So he's like the best option right now. If you want to like throw out some comps, some guys have said there's versions of Correa as a big shortstop. He has an inside out swing at times. So there's a little bit of Jeter in there. I think he's the best option right now, but there's not like a huge 70 tool, massive bat speed, crazy athlete. He's just very good. The next two guys you're probably familiar with would be Jack Leiter and Kamar Rocker out of Vanderbilt. I think the consensus is Leiter has slid ahead of Rocker right now. He is in the sort of Max Meyer, Walker Buehler kind of area, as like the sort of medium framed righty with the vertically oriented analyst friendly stuff. Rocker, the question with him is, I mean, people expected him to go wire to wire first overall after that freshman performance. Since then, he hasn't been that great, but it's also been early season, not great competition. He hasn't had to turn it on yet. And so scouts are a little bit worried. Is he going to have that extra gear? If he does, then he'll probably go first or second. If he doesn't, then it's, you know, third to sixth, not a huge fall. And then behind him, the sort of biggest question in the draft right now is the college position players. You know, it's the top three. I haven't even mentioned one yet. UCLA shortstop Matt McClain right now, I have as fifth. He's probably the best option because these guys don't have the multi-year track record of down the stretch in their sophomore season. Scouts are seeing him in conference tournaments. Then they see him in the summer at Team USA Cape Cod League. And then they know to bear down on him early in the spring. None of that stuff happened. And so the guys that are performance guys that don't really look the part, the example I used is last year's 14th overall pick, Justin Foscue out of Mississippi State. He was a great second half of the sophomore year, Team USA. Everybody was comfortable with it. And then all spring guys bared down on him. And he worked his way into the middle of the first round. That version of that guy this year is probably in the second round and has a couple months for teams to really figure him out. And so the top of that list is McClain, Miami catcher Adrian Del Castillo, and 5'9 Boston College center fielder Sal Frelick probably is in the top half of the first round right now. But that will be the area that sort of sorts itself out the most this spring.
Top five picks: Pirates, Rangers, Tigers, Red Sox, and Orioles. And that's in the order. So Pirates with a lot of choices to be made coming up here. All right, Kylie, we'll be talking with you.
Yep. Thanks for having me on.
Jenny Kapnar is a broadcaster for Rockies on television. And Jenny, obviously the big story about the offseason was the trade of Nolan Arenado. What was the impact of that within the organization in your eyes?
Well, first of all, Buster, I just wanted to say I'm sorry I don't have any bird sounds for you. I was really going to try and get those to ring in the segment, right? We love it. It's spring. You know, I think with the Nolan idea, it's been turned the page inside the organization. I think it has to be for some of those players. I know it was disappointing news in the offseason for a lot of those guys. It's a tight-knit group. You know, Charlie Blackmon, Trevor Story, Nolan Arenado. When you talk about the success of the Rockies in the last 5 years, those guys have been the trio, kind of the foundation that it stood on. And so I think to lose Nolan, that was definitely hard. But I think at the end of the day, they all know it's a business. They all know they have to move forward. And they're going to have to do that with the guys in the clubhouse. So obviously business as usual there. I'm sure as you've seen from the fans and the reaction, it's obviously really hard to swallow when you're losing a generational player who's played in one uniform his whole career so far and done a fantastic job and obviously won a lot of hardware. And it's hard to lose one of the best third basemen in the game. And arguably the best third baseman of this generation. So to go to St. Louis, that's hard. I'm happy for Nolan as a person. I think he, you know, he wants to be with a winning franchise. He has some goals. And I think being able to watch him for the last 8 seasons, like what a pleasure to watch that guy each and every night. So as I told some broadcasters in St. Louis, enjoy it. You're lucky that you get to see that.
I remember having a conversation with you before about him, and you know, you talked about his style of play and the impact that he had. Did it just come down in your eyes to irreconcilable differences?
I think a little bit. I think that was the start of it for sure, Buster. You know, I think going into last season, there was a lot of public display from Nolan that he was upset. He was upset with the direction of the organization. He felt when he signed that long-term deal that he was really going to be staying with a team that wanted to win. And he felt like having gone to the playoffs for back-to-back seasons and then having a losing season in 19 and the front office not doing much in the offseason to make the team better, I think that really bothered him. And obviously it was 2020, the pandemic. Cherry on top was the fact that a lot of teams and a lot of owners lost a ton of money. And when you start to look at, you know, David Dahl not coming back and Tony Walters, guys that didn't make a ton of money on the team, you started to realize they're going to do some shaving here. And when you look at Nolan's salary, it made up almost 30% of what the Rockies were going to be able to do in terms of their overall salary. So I think long-term vision, it just with his opt-out coming up after this season, they felt like he was probably going to opt for free agency and move along anyways. And they felt that it was the right time to make a deal. So obviously that deal needs to play out and needs to see where it goes before anyone can really review it. It felt weird out of the gate for the Rockies to be giving money over to St. Louis as well. And I know there's some issues there, but I think just for the Rockies, it was time and they were going to be doing something this offseason and it happened.
Trevor Story could become part of the greatest class of free agent shortstops in the history of baseball in the fall. He'll be eligible for free agency then. What's your sense of where the status of he is with the Rockies and how the Rockies are going to handle that going forward?
You know, in talking to Trevor once he got to spring training, he said, you know, there's no discussions now. I'm sure on some sort of front, before spring training, after the Nolan trade, there was probably conversations about an extension, what that might look like. But I think a lot of things have to play out. Obviously, he could be trade bait come trade deadline. He could make it to the end of the year. The Rockies could offer him something. He could still walk away into free agency. But I'm with you. You're going to have a lot of competition on the free agent market for shortstops this offseason. And I think it's going to come down to what the best fit is for Trevor. I know he's ranked as one of the top shortstops in the game right now. He's been a producer for the last couple of years, and I think he still has more to prove in the tank. You know, this is a guy that's very competitive. He wants to have a 30-30 season. He's not shy about that. He wants to steal bases. He wants to hit home runs, and he wants to win a gold glove. He's a true five-tool player in the game, and if you look around the division alone, there's some great shortstops. in the NL West, and he's definitely proven year after year that he belongs in that conversation.
You know, he's been a good player for a long time, but it feels like he is really underrated, that casual fans don't understand how good he is. Tell us why, you know, what you see in him as a player.
Well, I think the casual fan always looks at a Colorado Rockies uniform and says it's easy to hit home runs when your home ballpark is Coors Field. So I think that's one of the reasons why he's kind of gone under the radar. But I think for Trevor, what makes him special is he has a lot of internal instincts like Nolan Arenado. And I think those two playing on the left side together for so long pushed each other. And you can look offensively at his abilities and what he can do. I just mentioned it. I mean, this is a guy that can steal bases when he's on base. He can hit home runs. He can, you know, hit for average. And all of a sudden, people overlook his defense. And his defense is Gold Glove caliber. I mean, the way he moves, his range that he has, his ability to just be an athlete out there. And again, it's not good enough for him. He still works so hard at his craft, and every offseason he has very specific goals. He's not very public about his goals, but I know he puts numbers in his head of what he wants to do defensively and offensively. And, you know, he's going to be the first that's really hard on himself to get there. So it's been really fun to watch him mature. And I think more than just the baseball player he is, he's a really good human being. And I don't even think we've seen his leadership skills come into play yet. I think he's grown into his own. And now all of a sudden in that clubhouse, you're seeing a different Trevor Story and a different Charlie Blackmon this year, because they understand there's a lot of young players around them that need some extra time, that need some seasoning, that need that extra conversation. And so I think we're going to even see a different side of Trevor emerge this year in kind of more of a public leader.
Jenny, give me a pivotal guy on the roster in your eyes.
Well, I think a pivotal guy this year is going to be a Brendan Rodgers or a Ryan McMahon. And the reason why is when the Rockies got rid of Nolan Arenado and did the trade, they said they felt they had the talent inside. They just needed to step up. And Ryan McMahon has had his opportunities over the last 2 years. And offensively, we've seen some spots of power, but we've seen a lot of strikeouts. He has to clean things up at the plate. They need him in that lineup. He's also going to be moving over to his natural position at third base. And that's going to be hard shoes to fill, obviously, when you talk about the absence of Arenado. But I think his transition from second to third is going to help. And that opens up second base. Brendan Rodgers has been a highly touted prospect for a long time. And every time he's had his opportunity, injuries have gotten in the way. He hasn't proved himself. And I think this year he's come in with a different attitude. He's come in with the attitude of a big leaguer. He knows what's at stake. He has to make this team, and he has to really be consistent. And I think for Brendan Rodgers, when you look at it, it will be the key to the lineup and how Bud Black's able to construct that every day.
45 seconds. Tell me how much the Rockies would benefit if there's a 24th hour discussion about expanded playoffs.
Well, I think they benefit a lot. You look around the NL West, and obviously the Rockies were the only team to not go get a free agent. They have a lot of young talent. They're relying on that. They have a lot to prove. The Dodgers, the Padres, they went out and got even better than they already are. So you talk about two teams in the division you already see going into the playoffs. If one of them's winning it and one of them's getting the wild card, it's very hard for a third NL West team to sneak in there with some talent that you have, especially in the National League East, probably getting another wild card. So I think it would benefit extremely. And you talk about just the excitement. We had so much fun watching the 2020 playoffs, and I think expansion would be great for the game. And I know for a team like the Rockies, it would really benefit in the future.
Yeah, you really hope that they work it out, that they could expand the playoffs, because it just provides more hope for more teams. We'll see how that goes. Jenny, thanks for doing this.
Hey, thanks, Buster. Appreciate it.
Bleacher Tweets.
Alrighty, Buster, Bleacher Tweets for a glorious Friday. First up, the question everyone wants to know on the internet from PK Steinberg. He writes in, Buster, you're up late and up early and active all day. Coffee? Espresso? How many cups? Shots? What is your secret? I don't know the secret either. Please share.
So I make a big pot of coffee in the morning and I start ingesting that. And it's pretty strong. In fact, one of my favorite things to do, I have this cat named Bart, who's a, you know, he's a great cat. But sometimes he can be a little pushy in terms of play with me, play with me, play with me. And so when I want to back him off after I make the coffee, if I wave my coffee cup near him, he jumps down and goes away.
Interesting.
Because coffee, because the coffee smell is so strong. He does not like that. I have one cup in the afternoon after a brief nap. My mother was the greatest catnapper in the history of the world. I can catnap for 2 minutes and feel completely refreshed.
Whoa, that is the secret there. Wow.
Yep.
Okay.
I need like 90 seconds, 2 minutes to close my eyes.
Damn, I'm jealous. I'm legitimately jealous over here. Let's go to Mitchell, Tigers of Detroit. He writes in, how you often hear players hunting first pitch fastballs with the ball change. Do you expect a lot more guys sitting on first pitch curves?
Mitchell, no, I don't think so. Because even if you're looking for a curveball, there's so much that's unknown. It's definitely easier to focus on trying to hit fastballs. Now, I have certainly talked to hitters through the years where they talk about, you know what, I went up there guessing on a first pitch curveball and getting a big hit. And sometimes you're watching a game and somebody swings at a first pitch curveball and they swing and miss. And you just see the wry look on their face, like they guessed on that curveball and they were right, but they couldn't get to it.
All right. Next one up, Corey Rukert at CoreyR_12. He writes in, is the Mets signing Lindor really that important? Hear me out. Lindor is obviously great, but the shortstop market next year is huge. And if Lindor walks, they can still possibly sign Story, Baez, Seager, Correa, etc.
Bird in the hand versus two in the bush. Yeah, you could theoretically walk away from the Lindor negotiations and just gamble you're going to sign somebody in the fall. But remember, you know, there's so much uncertainty about how the market's going to play out. You know, Javier Baez goes up and down with his offense because he expands the strike zone so much. Carlos Correa has had injury issues. Corey Seager is represented by Scott Boras. So, you know, he probably is going to wind up going to the biggest, the biggest offer. And he plays with the Dodgers. So they may decide they want to retain him. I think the Mets absolutely got Lindor with the idea of being, we need to sign him and lock him up because he's one of the best players in baseball.
Good question, Corey. Last one for the week. Molten Bolesworth at GoJones71 writes in, will the quote-unquote anything goes spring training rules, ending innings or games whenever they feel like it, continue next year? Are these COVID-specific rules?
No, I think they'll continue. The whole thing about when a pitcher gets to 20 pitches or 22 pitches, the manager says, okay, that's it. We're going to just stop the inning. I think a lot of teams feel that way, as opposed to getting a pitcher warmed up and having him throw two pitches and then him being out and the guy who they want to continue pitching being out. I think a lot of that stuff is going to stay. A lot of those rules, Moulton, through this pandemic, they're definitely have gained traction as baseball moves forward.
All righty. That is it for Bleacher Tweets for the week. Hashtag Bleacher Tweets on Twitter. And please follow, rate, and review this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks, everyone.
And that's it for today. That's it for this week. My thanks to Jenny, to Carl, to Kylie, and Taylor. Have a great day, everybody. Thanks for listening. Stay safe. And remember, hate and inequality based on skin color is something we need to fight against every single day.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, check out the Fantasy Focus podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. The Baseball Tonight podcast.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.